Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Chandler Kling Smith, author of The Sky Is Yours, published this January by Hogarth. Chandler is a graduate of Bennington and the Creative Writing MFA program at Columbia. She's worked in book publishing, and she currently lives, teaches, and tutors in New York City. The Sky Is Yours is Chandler's first novel, but it will definitely not be her last. We are in the future. We're in Empire Island, a lot like New York City. It's a crumbling edifice to man's folly. And on top of that, it's beset by a pair of fire-breathing dragons who languidly circle the city, belching fire at buildings and people in a somewhat, perhaps, haphazard way. Especially interested in Torchtown, which is a prison colony set inside of the city and self-governed in a kind of Machiavellian but workable manner. Against this background emerge our three protagonists, Duncan, Swanee, and Abby, who run away under the most unsettling of circumstances and settle in various parts of the heart of darkness that is Empire. Because of the ubiquitous dragons and their flame-throwing Duncan, who is or was a spoiled brat with a serious case of affluenza, he has an inhaler, becomes a fireman, and a good one. Abby, a magical and lovely enchantress of sorts, takes us through a maze of riddles and wanders to a crystalline point, and which to say more would be a spoiler. Abby surprises all of us with a mouthful of extra teeth, a lot more spunk than one would expect, as she settles and thrives in Torchtown with an unkempt and canny Sharky, who reminds me of Danny DeVito, where she doles out licorice-like skeins of soporific and vintage drugs. The momentum of the novel is almost musical, and the latter part of the book is like the pull string at the top of a velvet bag, drawing the characters together, and their many finely drawn ones, beside the protagonist, tighter and tighter into a point where we all understand, kinda sorta, where we have been and perhaps where we're going. And on top of everything else, Chandler's agent is Bill Clegg, who I've interviewed, and I've interviewed most of the authors of his books, his agency's books, who is probably the best agent in the world. And with that and my usual run on sentences, welcome to the show, Chandler, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and that was such a great introduction. I really love the way that you, characterize the book and some of the thematic and imaginative material I'm dealing with, so that's awesome.
I appreciate that. Before I begin my off-the-wall questions, which they will be, and because we're here to sell your book, hopefully in my bookstore where it sits proudly on our front table,
thank you so much, yeah.
Yeah, well, so tell us a little bit about the book from your perspective, not mine.
Yeah, I think that the way that you characterized it is really great. Like, it is about this, you know, crumbling city that's both futuristic but then also fantastical in a way that evokes fairy tales. One of the things I was really interested in was bringing together a lot of different genres into a single whole. So the first third of the book really centers on a marriage plot. Then there's sort of a picaresque slash quest narrative with a bit of a murder mystery thrown in. We get into the most science fiction oriented stuff in the last third of the book, with, you know, sort of getting to the heart of what the dragons really are and where they come from. So, that's definitely something that I thought about a lot, like how to bring together different narrative structures that I love as a reader and have them all work together in some sort of surprising way. So,
well, going along with that and your thought process, how did Empire Island come to be? Did it spring like full-blown like Athena from Zeus's head, or did it construct itself brick by brick in your mind and hand?
It's actually a bit of both. Like, the very first vision I had for this novel was of Abby standing on her garbage island watching the dragons attacking the skyline of the city in the distance. So I did, from the very beginning, have a sense of I wanted it to be this really epic setting that would kind of announce itself and be extremely dramatic and kind of lead to, you know, dramatic situations for all of the characters inside of it. But with this project, I also really discovered that I had to dig into world building in a way I never had in my fiction before. I've written a little bit of lightly researched historical fiction, but other than that, everything I've written before this has been set more or less in our world with maybe just like one fantastical intrusion. So here I found myself realizing I have to decide, you know, is there a police force and how functional are they? Is there a fire department and how functional are they? Is there a sewer system? Like, you know, how are people getting water or food? Or all of these different questions came up as I was working through the novel. So I often would have to stop and kind of think about what are the systems underlying this place.
Wow.
So, it was kind of constructed brick by brick, but, like, after that, you know, initial maybe kind of architectural vision of it.
Yeah, and you really created, I knew it before, but now I really realize you created an entire infrastructure to a city.
I tried to. I certainly don't think that, you know, I'm sure that someone could find, like, you know, a loose end somewhere, but, like, I tried to have the things that mattered to the characters be thought through and realized on the page, because I feel like that's a risk that we take when we write speculative fiction, is that when you don't really know what options the characters have, when you don't know what's possible in the world, then the things they do don't end up feeling as meaningful or revealing about their characters.
Yeah, and it's really cool, too, because, like, when you're rowing down a river of raw sewage underground,
yeah,
you know, kind of like, it's cool because, you know, it evokes the River Styx, it evokes Charon and...
Totally.
And Cerebus and all that kind of stuff. So is that part...
Yeah.
Is Empire City really based in your mind? I mean, every review says it. Is it really based on New York City?
Yes, it's definitely based on New York City. I've lived here since 2005, so I definitely, that's my, like, frame of reference. And I actually, when I was first working on this book, I remember on my lunch break sitting in the shadow of the lipstick building where Bernie Madoff had his Ponzi scheme. And, writing about the lip gloss building, which, like, appears in my novel as a kind of landmark there. So I was always kind of trying to translate it imaginatively into being its own thing. But the point of inspiration, like, the thing that I was caricaturing, always the starting point was New York. And I'm really interested in, you know, exploring in this, like, satirical and imaginative way, like, a lot of the rottenness that's real, and that's, like, you know, that's part of our world. So things like income inequality and gentrification and, you know, stuff like that, mass incarceration, those were all things that I really, you know, was kind of taking from our world and then putting in the world of the book.
Okay, so going off on the first of my tangents, why did you give, without spoiling it, Swanee, and how did you even think of it, why did you give her so many teeth inward and outward?
I think that, like, where that first came from was actually when I was younger. I was born without, like, one of the teeth in the front of my mouth, and then I have a tiny, like, vestigial fang on the other side. So I had to have a ton of orthodontic work done. So there was something about the mouth that was, like, really tactile and familiar to me. And then when I was thinking about, again, not to get into spoilers too much, but I was thinking about this idea of sort of corruption that's, like, seeping into, you know, every aspect of the environment. So there's, you know, all of this trash and, you know, this dumping of, like, you know, biological materials and stuff in the book. I was really thinking, like, well, what would that be like sort of inside of a human body, like something that keeps sort of intruding and presenting itself. That for me then ended up becoming, what if she just keeps getting teeth, so, into adulthood?
It's like
it seemed really creepy and, yeah.
Yeah, I was born with, like, out my two eye teeth, so, like, for the first half of my...
That's amazing, yeah, that's totally, like, minor. The ones, the eye teeth are the sort of fang-shaped ones, right? Like, right next to those are the ones that I'm missing, so that's so funny. Like,
I'm using my tongue now to figure out if you're right. Yeah, and what happened was I had these half-assed bridges, some of them removable and all that, and then my good friend Jay Harrington, who's a dentist, gave me this great bridge like 38 years ago. And
amazing.
The thing about it is he's died in the interim. And so, like, his bridge lives on. He lives on in my mouth.
That's amazing. I love that. He lives on in my mouth. That's, like, that's really beautiful and so strange as well.
It has some real evocative things, so.
With Swanee also, so I don't really remember exactly in what order I came up with this stuff, but then it was like, so I had all this stuff with her teeth, and then I had this other character making chaw, you know, the psychotropic chaw that's, like, you know, you were describing as being like licorice, that's this hallucinogen people take in the world of the novel. And I was like, oh, how perfect that someone who's always teething would then end up, you know, getting getting really involved with this drug that, like, you know, requires all of this chewing. It just seemed like there was this sort of, like, the strange way in which the imagery came together all around her mouth.
And it's good that she, like, she violates this prime directive, you know,
Yeah. Yeah, she starts working at this chaw shop in Torchtown, and the one rule that she has to obey, the sort of, like, you know, almost like something in a fairy tale that she's told never to do, is never taste the retail. So when she does, it comes with a heavy cost.
You know,
yeah.
Many reviews, I don't know where they get the word from, have called your novel hyper-imaginative. So what do you think of that? I read it, like, in three different reviews. I don't know what that means.
Well, I'm hugely flattered by it. I'm not entirely sure what it means either. But, like, I definitely think I was... imagination has always been, like, a really big part of my process. Like, I always try to, like, to lean into, like, the weirdest idea I have and think about, like, okay, well, what are the consequences of this? I teach a creative writing workshop, and I always tell my students, there's no such thing as too much. There's only not enough. So sometimes if you introduce something really strange, readers will be like, whoa, I don't know what that's doing here. But if you continue to investigate it and invest in it and, like, you know, excavate it, then it ends up justifying its presence more often than not.
Yeah.
Or you might decide you have to jettison it. But, to me, yeah, the key is really just to go hard in the direction of those imaginative impulses, no matter how weird they might seem at the beginning. So I'm glad that people seem to be digging that.
Yeah, and to put it basically, it's like if you have a kindergarten teacher that makes you draw inside the lines, or a kindergarten teacher that lets you draw outside the lines. So Duncan Humphrey Ripple V, he was a star of this kind of Andy Cohen type reality show, late capitalism's royalty. Is he modeled, and be honest, is he modeled after anyone in particular?
About a lot of different people when I was writing his character. I wouldn't say he has a single point of inspiration, but I did think about figures like Justin Bieber. I find him kind of fascinating, the idea of somebody growing up so much in the public eye and then having, you know, kind of constantly doubling down on his own arrogance in that space. Like, there's something about that seems kind of like kind of repulsive, but then also a little bit heartbreaking when you actually take the time to imagine yourself in that person's shoes, you know? So sort of growing up in front and doing everything in front of a camera. I also thought a little bit about, way back during the 2008 presidential election, Levi Johnston, Bristol Palin's, like, boyfriend, who was sort of thrust into the spotlight just basically because he got this girl pregnant in high school. And it was just, like, it was so sort of gross but also fascinating to see him kind of, like, you know, embrace the limelight and kind of, like, be this, again, you know, having this level of kind of arrogance but also total immaturity that seemed almost poignant when you really think about it. Like, I thought about people like that, and I also just thought about, I feel like there's something really symptomatic about our culture that we sort of are, you know, that we're kind of, like, willing to watch people, like, as far as they entertain us, but we're not necessarily, like, concerned about what that means for their personal growth. So, like, yeah, not that he should be protected from himself, because by the time my novel starts, he's almost 19, but, like, there is a sense in which he's stunted, and he's stunted because of something in the culture.
Hey, so what about his arranged marriage to the Baroness Swan Lenore Dahlberg? Do you imagine that these mergers may become commonplace in our country, like, say, Ivanka and Jared Kushner? I mean...
It's so funny, so when I started writing this book back in, like, 2009, and, you know, at that point, Donald Trump was somebody that I was familiar with through things like The Apprentice and him just sort of being this, you know, media impresario, but I really had no idea that he would end up becoming, I mean, the President of the United States. Like, I continue to be shocked and horrified
by
that.
Every morning I wake up, and the first thought I have is Donald J. Trump is President of the United States of America. And that's almost, and then I begin my science fiction life.
Yeah,
every day.
I know. It's like laugh or cry, right? Like, it's heartbreaking, but it's also just, like, so absolutely surreal. It's like, what are you even gonna say about it? But yeah, I mean, I definitely think that he's somebody who typifies this really, I mean, you know, obviously regressive sexual politics, regressive everything politics, basically. So in terms of the gender roles in the novel, I was kind of imagining, it seems like when sometimes when a society is kind of pushed to a breaking point, there can be this very, like, regressive, conservative turning back the clock kind of thing. So I talk about Swanee's mother is someone who used to be a really successful advertising executive, but then she's now grooming her daughter for this arranged marriage. And, you know, the idea of kind of, like, seeing a sort of, like, trend in feminism peak and then fall back, that seemed like something that was, like, really fascinating to me when I was thinking about dystopian stuff to cover in the book.
You know, it's
and, yeah, so, and I also thought that it was believable that, you know, Duncan's parents would, or his father, anyway, would realize my son is going to completely run the family, you know, the family holdings and status into the ground if he's left to his own devices, so I'll try to find somebody who can, you know, put some sort of level of control on that in the form of this wife. So, yeah.
Well, you know, one thing that fascinated me about the book, because it's really hard for novelists to do this, is how did you decide that the three protagonists would get equal, not decide, how were you able to have them have equal weight? Because they were, you know, if you had the scale that you measured these guys on, it would be flat straight across because they all have equal parts in the story.
I'm so glad that you say that, because actually you were talking about my brilliant agent, Bill, who was just absolutely, you know, invaluable to this project. I mean, he helped me so much when I was revising it before we went out to editors, and even after I was working with my editor, he continued to give feedback and stuff. And one of the things that he really encouraged me to do and that I think really works is that Abby kind of disappeared for a little bit in the middle of the book. Like, she was, I mean, obviously she was still there, but, like, he really was like, okay, we need to, like, make sure that we're tracking her arc and giving it the same amount of space, because she's very important, or and always has been very important in the first and last parts of the book, but in the middle she kind of like faded out. So he was really like, you know, you need to be thinking about her journey, what her motivations are, what she wants, what she's sort of working on in the background when these things are going on with Swanee and Ripple. So I'm glad that that came through. I was definitely, pleased with, like, but yeah, I mean, it was challenging, definitely. I was interested in what each of them kind of represented. That Duncan is kind of, he's gone full pop culture, you know. Swanee is someone who is sort of, even though she's from this formerly aristocratic family that's kind of fallen on hard times, she really embraces that aristocratic bearing, and she is very snobbish and intellectual. And then Abby is this sort of feral, natural, untamed person who kind of represents the sort of weird nature that comes out of the Anthropocene, you know. So, yeah. So I kind of like was interested in all three of those threads.
Yeah, and each of them have. I mean, especially, it's hard to say. I mean, each of them are crucial to the book, and they each have characteristics that either grow or change or surprise you. Especially like Swanee, you never expected her to be as strong as she was, or to respond to things as she did. And and then Duncan grows into this, you know, kind of, you know, grown up. And
yeah, exactly. Like, I forget exactly how someone in a review I read said something about that, you know, he goes from being like a stupid man child to being a stupid man, and that still represents progress. And I was like, I completely agree with that. He doesn't completely become a different person, but he acquires some degree of self-awareness and of, you know, thinking about others in a way that he hasn't been capable of before.
Well, which brings
I hope that that's satisfying for readers as a form of progress. Like, he doesn't become aspirational, but he becomes,
And speaking of which, in your real life, how many people have you met on your tour or whatever press you're doing that actually think you're a man?
You know, that actually hasn't happened as much as you might think, because, yeah, obviously I have this very gender-neutral name. One person mentioned the book in a podcast and referred to me, you know, as he, and then, you know, I actually only found out about that because then he tweeted something about, oh, I'm so sorry that, like, I misgendered you. But, yeah, like, for the most part, I think the fact that I have an author photo on the book helps, but we'll see if that ends up happening more. The book just came out last week. So.
Yeah. Well, so how did you, and one of the reviews were saying, you know, you got inside the head of Duncan and you're a girl and a woman and all that. So how did you come up with the titles for Duncan's video porn collection?
That was actually something that, like, every time I revised the book, I would add something or, you know, come up with, like, another joke that cracked me up. Like, so obviously, as you can tell from the book, I have a very bawdy sense of humor, and that was just this opportunity for me to sort of throw in every sexual joke I could possibly think of. So, I mean, there are references in that list to Dune. He has, like, a video category called Ride the Worm, which, you know, I've always thought sounds, like, sexual. There's actually a David Foster Wallace reference in that list that one reviewer picked up on, which delighted me. He has a category called Big Red Sun, which is the name of David Foster Wallace's essay about attending the porn awards. So each one, there's kind of a different explanation, but it was always a question of amusing myself. Oh, there's an Edward Gorey reference in that list. There's something that he has called, like, Love Seat or The Curious Couch, which is based on, like, an Edward Gorey, like, short story about that ends with, like, a sort of sexualized couch. I have a weird sense of humor, I guess.
Plus, we were talking before about, like, Philip K. Dick and all of your science fiction guys in the past that have kind of shaped parts of the novel and how you bring them in peripherally, but to people who are aficionados of you know, these guys and women. And then it was really sad that Ursula K. Le Guin died last, you know, week or...
I actually found out about that, like, right before my book launch, and it was so sad. I mean, she's just obviously just such a hugely influential figure. So
well, it's like standing on the shoulders of giants. That's what you're doing now, and, you know, she would be very proud of it, I imagine.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, you know, I was gonna say who's your favorite character, but I'll say it because my favorite character really is Sharky.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And in addition to him reminding me of Danny DeVito, mostly because of the hair, he also reminds me of Bob Hoskins from Roger Rabbit.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I can totally see that. I also thought of Joe Pesci, especially in Casino.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, totally. There's a scene where Joe Pesci is playing blackjack in that movie that I find so poignant when he's like, he sort of had a falling out with De Niro and is missing him. And he's like, there's this combination of he's really dangerous, but he's also really vulnerable. And there's something about that that definitely carried over into this character.
Yeah,
I also thought about, not in terms of physicality, because he's very tall and Sharky's very short, but Daniel Day-Lewis in Gangs of New York. I'm just a big Scorsese fan in general. So.
Yeah, me too. But no, you did a really good job because you make him, as you said, vulnerable. Essentially, in the town, he's invulnerable. And then with Swanee, he's totally vulnerable. And he knows both of these things, you know, to the core of his body.
So it's so cool that you really, like, connected with him because, I mean, obviously he does so many terrible things in the book. And I don't see, you know, I certainly don't see a lot of his behavior as being sympathetic. But, of course, like, when you write a character and you spend a lot of time inside of their head, you do kind of fall in love with them, and I felt that way about him. So.
And then you have, you know, the two little boys hiding behind the counter, and it's kind of like they're like the little Hansel and Gretel of the book.
Yeah, totally.
And then you feel for them, and then, you know, you feel a different way for them without giving anything away. But
right.
And then the guy who, like, you know, who takes care of them, and he's you know, a mobster too. I mean, but he has this heart of gold,
totally.
I guess you would say.
Something I was really interested in with Torchtown is this, like, kind of idea of fallenness. Like, I'm a big Thomas Pynchon fan, and he writes about, especially in Gravity's Rainbow, like, the preterite and the idea that we're all fallen. And I think, like, Torchtown for me is a microcosm of that. Like, what does it mean to be sort of born into a prison colony, to be kind of born into this conception of, like, having some kind of original sin that's, like, landed you there? And what kind of compromises do you end up making because that's your self-perception? Like, you know, there's something very self-perpetuating about that. And I think about, like, just systems in real human life as well, like, that we all kind of feel like, you know, we kind of go into the world compromised. Nobody has a completely blank slate.
You know, talking about these references to all the different things we're talking about, the book is kind of cinematic, so do you...
Thank you, yeah.
I think, you know, this is great. It's your first book and all that. I assume, I don't know if you've been approached yet, but with Bill Clegg and all the other stuff, it seems like you'll be approached by somebody who wants to option this or write a screenplay for, because it's got all
that
the elements.
That would be phenomenal, yeah. I mean, I know Bill's, like, looking into it, and that's all I know so far. Like, there's nothing that's, like, that's happened or been agreed upon yet, but, like, fingers crossed. Like, I'd love to see it as a movie or a show.
It's like tomorrow I interview Jojo Moyes, who wrote Me Before You, and then whatever, and then Still Me, and all. It's a trilogy. But when I first interviewed her for Me Before You, it was like 5 years ago, and she was just, not just, but she really wasn't well known. And then, then the movie came out like 1 year afterwards, and then now all her back stock is now in my store with the same type of idealized cover, stylized cover.
Yeah.
And,
it's, just, it's incredible what, you know, having an adaptation can do for the visibility of a book. I mean, you know, I'd love to have something be made just because I'd love to see somebody else's vision of it, but I also, you know, it totally has that added benefit. And even for me as a reader, I mean, you know, things will get on my radar in a way that they hadn't before just because they're getting made into a film. So,
well, it's like another science fiction one. I interviewed Andy Weir for The Martian.
Oh, awesome,
and
yeah.
And it seems like a year after I interview him, I'm watching Matt Damon play him. So maybe it'll
happen. That's got to be just so incredible for Andy Weir to, like, have that experience. Yeah, I'm, like, totally jealous. But,
well, that's what I asked him. I said, "This, can you wrap your head around what's happening?" Oh, I interviewed him again for the one he just did.
Artemis?
Excuse me?
What it's called?
Artemis, yes, about the colony on the moon. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's so cool about him, he's like a lot of old school science fiction writers. Like, he has incredible ideas and he has this great science and it's all always right. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but when he gets to like characters or sex, he has a hard time with that, like Robert Heinlein used to do.
Yeah, I think that we all have the things that we gravitate toward. Like,
well, you're good with the sex.
I'm good with characters and sex, but I know nothing about science. So all my science is sort of like, you know, I sort of go with that idea of, like, if it's so futuristic, it's almost indistinguishable from magic. And magic is something that I feel comfortable with, but not so much with, like, actual science.
Yeah, that's right from Arthur C. Clarke, you know.
Right, yeah. I was trying to remember who said that. I was like, it's one of those quotes you've heard a million times, but, yeah. But,
totally. Well, like, some from the reviews, and if I call what I've read from the reviews, you imagine it like, you know, everyone's saying, like, Blade Runner, or other things, or the way I looked at it was like a Slumlord's kind of Oz, you know? It's like,
oh, cool.
But
if
it was Transformed, what do you see it like, you know, dark and smoke and
I was really influenced by the Terry Gilliam movie Brazil.
Oh,
so
I love that movie.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I really love the way that it combines this kind of, like, you have antiquated technology combined with, like, futuristic technology combined with just fantastical technology. So he has, like, a face recognition robot in one scene, but then, you know, when the two guys are fighting over the computer console in their office, it's just, like, you know, looks like something from, you know, the early days of computers. So I think that there's just something so fun about the way that he's willing to kind of have his tentacles go in every direction visually, and you've got, like, the mom with the shoe hat and just wonderful costuming choices like that.
Yeah,
and I definitely imagine that.
Yeah, in all of his movies. And I like the part where Robert De Niro, again, going back to Scorsese, but Robert De Niro swinging in and then opening the panel and the wall, and there's all this wiring.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The ducks and, like, yeah, the way that, like, that, yeah, it's, like, almost in a literal way, like, the tentacles of technology reaching into people's everyday lives. So, yeah, so I mean, I kind of imagine it having a bit of a Terry Gilliam aesthetic, especially Terry Gilliam circa Brazil. But, like, I would also just be really so open to seeing what someone else would do with it. Something I loved about this whole process was the cover. Like, the folks at Hogarth Crown, like, reached out to me and were like, you know, what are some covers that you like? Do you have any ideas? I sent them a bunch of ideas and stuff. And then Michael Morris, the guy who designed the book, like, you know, he read it and he just came up with this image that was so different from and so much better than anything I could have pictured. So I just love that collaborative thing when somebody takes your vision and does their own thing with it and you're like, yes, this is like, yeah.
And, you know, the thing about Liz is owning an independent bookstore. As many times as you hear, don't judge a book by its cover, everybody who comes into my bookstore, everybody, no exceptions, judges books by their cover.
100%. I'm totally like that, too. I mean, I love the book as a physical object, and I'm going to be drawn to ones that are gorgeous. So I'm really lucky that, like, at least to my eye, this is, like, something that I would reach for. So I was, like, really thrilled about that.
Well, it's like a magpie, too, because it has so much color to it, you know? You kind of run to it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool?
Yeah, definitely something you can see from across the room.
Yeah, exactly. And the neon look. Wouldn't it be cool if Terry Gilliam picked the movie up?
Oh, my God. I would be, like, so thrilled. But, like, yeah, I mean, he's working on his Don Quixote adaptation, though. So I want him to finish that finally before he gets distracted with anything else.
I want to watch the documentary about the making of Don Quixote, because all of his movies are like that. Like, you know, they go over budget. He has problems.
Yeah.
But that would be amazing. So,
the documentary about that was so fascinating and kind of heartbreaking, because it's like, you know, I desperately want to see that movie, and then watching him, it was basically like he was like Job or something, that, you know, even the weather turned against him. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was like that commentary documentary on Apocalypse Now.
Yes, that one's also really fascinating. Hearts of Darkness, right?
Yeah.
That's terrific. I'm glad I'm not a film director. It's got to be like that. It's hard enough just, you know, using your own imagination to arrive somewhere when you have to work with so many other people and just conditions. Like, that's got to be next to impossible.
Well, so this JoJo Moyes, she wrote the screenplay for Me Before You, and she's going to write the screenplay for the next one. So you probably ought to start prepping for that, I guess. Who knows?
Yeah, I would love to do something like that. I mean, I think that I have like just a tiny bit of experience with like screenwriting, really more just for myself. Like, I have taken a screenwriting class before, and there's something, as you can see in this book, I even have parts that are in screenplay format, and there's something really freeing about, you know, being able to visualize your stories in a different way.
To end off with, I'll ask like a Terry Gross, you know, kind of like regular question, because I don't ask regular questions.
Sure.
So, what are you trying to say in this book?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. I guess that I was really interested in this idea. I was talking a little bit before about fallenness, and I'm also really interested in inheritance. Like, you know, and I kind of explicitly say that at a few points in the book. Like, this is a story of what it is to be young in a very old world. Like, you know, this is a story about inheritance. So I'm kind of curious about, like, you know, when we're sort of coming of age in our lives, like, you know, how do we balance like the burden of expectations and limitations that are inherent in a world that's already so flawed with that sort of sense that, you know, the possibilities are limitless and it's all in us to make choices. So I guess that's like kind of a clumsy answer to that very, very thought-provoking question.
Well, I think the kind of answer it is a partial answer, because there's so much more. And what's cool about it is it's almost like a novel of manners in a sense, between Duncan and Swanee and Abby. But at the same time, it's overlaid with this, you know, technological science fiction story. So it has these two elements. Well, it has lots of elements, but those specific elements. And I think you've explained it very well. So,
yeah, no, totally. Society is both our technology and also, like, you know, sort of the social science of our world. So I'm interested in both of those.
So anyway, if you ever get a chance and you're down in outside of Philadelphia, come by the bookstore. And if not, maybe when the paperback version comes out, I'll contact Bill or your publicist and see if we can arrange something at our store. I think it would be great.
I would love to come sooner rather than later, so we'll be in touch. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
It was a pleasure.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
We were talking with Chandler Klang Smith. Her first novel, The Sky Is Yours, which is great. It's a great science fiction read. If you like science fiction, you'll love it. Even if you don't like science fiction, as we were talking about, it's got a much broader message, but the truth is, it's written so well that you'll find yourself, you know, reading through it pretty quickly. And if you're like me, you'll read the whole thing at one sitting. But it's really good. And she's just, you know, it's her first novel. And, you know, she's just very young. And she's got an incredible future in front of her. And because she does stand on the shoulder of the giants behind her, and she recognizes them and has read all of them, it's great for somebody else who's read Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury and Theodore Sturgeon and even Andy Weir. It's really a great feeling because you're familiar with all the references. And we have, you know, a lot of other authors like that coming up. And as I was talking with Chandler, JoJo Moyes will be here for the second time to discuss her latest novel, Still Me, which is the third of the trilogy. And Zenit Alihu will be here to share her highly anticipated debut novel, Brass. And then author Matt Haig is coming by to talk about his latest novel, How to Stop Time, which is also kind of science fiction-y in a way, but almost like picaresque in a way. Definitely picaresque, because it deals with immortality. And I'll say no more about that, but how can you not read a book dealing with immortality? So in any event, join us. And as I've said many times before, I love talking to these people, especially these new and upcoming artists, authors, and then people like David Mitchell and Isabel Allende, who have been around and are just geniuses. So as always, I look forward to seeing you next time here on the Avid Reader.